Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
You're listening to First Time Dads!
With me, Richard Innes.
And me, Steve Miles.
You might think that being a doctor would make being a dad a little bit easier. Truth is, if anything, it can make it a bit more difficult, as our guest on this episode is about to explain.
We spoke to Dr. Oscar Duke, who is a television presenter and author of How to Be a Dad, Pregnancy, Birth and Dirty Nappies for the Modern Man. I wasn't in the studio for this one, but Rich will explain that.
Hello, Oscar. Thank you very much for coming in and joining us.
Thanks for having me.
As we should probably, just before we dive in, you're going to hear a very tinny-sounding voice in the background in a moment, and that will be my co-host, Steve Mile, who is still at home recuperating from a double hernia.
Hello.
Sounding suitably sorrowful and you know, kind of full of self-pity in the background there, Steve.
Yeah, getting a bit week two, starting to get a bit boring.
Yeah, I bet it is. Well, ironically, given that Steve's just been subject to quite a dramatic procedure, Oscar is a GP and a doctor. So Steve's already picked his brains on his recovery. Off air, so now we can get into the serious business of talking about dadding and doctoring.
You're a new dad, Oscar, aren't you? Relatively new dad.
Yeah, relatively new. I've got a daughter who's 15 months old now, so it feels like only yesterday. But I keep saying to people, oh, I'm a new dad, and you know, actually, you can't get that badge anymore.
I'm not sure where the cutoff comes. Actually, I think maybe it's once you if you then do have a second child, maybe that is then the cutoff. It's very difficult to say I'm a new dad when it's like, well, actually, I've done it twice.
Yes.
I think, but up until the point where I had my second son, I think I would probably still describe myself as a new dad, maybe just in the sense that I still don't feel like I know what the hell I'm doing.
I feel like most people, if you say your baby's over a year old and you still say you're a new dad, look at you a bit like, that's not new.
you're just scared.
You should be fully accustomed to all the sleep deprivation and any problems that dads might have.
Now, Oscar, she's 15 months. My daughter's 15 months. How's she sleeping? My daughter doesn't sleep.
I have to say we have been those sort of annoying parents.
He's going to say she sleeps.
It's been really good.
I knew you. They say never ask a question before you know that you don't already know the answer to, and I knew what that was going to be the answer. You know?
I can hear Steve's teeth gritting down the line.
Grinding.
Here. Grinding. Grinding.
It's the classic sort of group from some antenatal class, isn't it? The annoying parent.
You have to apologise for being lucky with your child behaving well, which you know is just kind of social etiquette, but also is a bit mental.
No walking.
I'm really sorry that I'm not stressed out, you know. But that's,
did you say no walking?
No walking. Not a big mover.
Sort of. Mine's running.
Well, there you go. You see.
Mine has got her own New Balance. That's how much running she's doing.
Good Lord!
Thank goodness for all the different developmental domains so you can tick at least one box. Yeah, very good. Well, talker. Exactly.
My first big question to you, Oscar, would be regarding, and we did just discuss this before we started recording. So regarding your own 15-month-old, because my son actually went had some surgery at Great Ormond Street when he was 6 months old, and he's been in hospital several times. And knowing how stressful that can be, as a doctor, when we go into hospital, and as I say, we've been in several times, we put ourselves in the hands of the doctors and their expertise and their training and their experience. You obviously are a doctor, so you know what these guys know. So how does it differ for you when you go in with your child? Have you had an experience yet where your daughter's been sick or?
So touch wood, other than the birth, no. I think I sort of see it, I suppose, in my job all the time because there was the doctor me before I was a dad and then now. It really came home for me actually in the other part of, rather than doctoring all the time, but when I'm doing some documentaries in the media side of my work, that I went to Moorfields Eye Hospital to do a documentary for their NHS 70th anniversary. And it was actually just after my daughter had been born. And I've been into operating theatres loads of times. And then we were going to see this latest stem cell research operation, which was hoping to restore this young girl's vision. So it was quite a big sort of poignant moment. And the very experienced director and cameraman who were with me, I suddenly found outside, and we'd all changed into scrubs, and there'd been a bit of a laugh about that. And suddenly they were both standing there in tears. And I thought, what on earth happened? And I said, you know, and they said, oh, there's just this thought of this tiny child going through this procedure and what that means for them and for their family. And I felt like I was a sort of really bad person because I hadn't even crossed my mind on that emotional level. And I think it's such a combination of all the training that you go through that you do probably have to be quite emotionally withdrawn as a doctor to function. Otherwise, you know, because there's a lot of sad stuff that we come across, a lot of happy stuff, but also a lot of sad stuff. So I had sort of felt nothing. I thought, God, I've even now had a baby. You know, I should be this person crying in the corridor outside. And these all these people had made some horrible documentaries in their time. But I didn't. And I think that has now come with time. And I think I would be a lot worse now. I really notice, you know, even like going to watch Mary Poppins with my daughter at the cinema, you know, like blubbing.
So you have softened, do you think?
Definitely softened, yeah.
My wife can't watch any drama about child abduction anymore. Not that that was a big part of her.
I was going to say, was that a regular? Was a regular bit of viewing in the Mile household?
No, there was a fave. The Missing, that program, The Missing.
And oh yeah,
you know, the stuff. You know, other stuff that you know. You just if that got an element of that in it, she just won't watch it.
Yeah, yeah, no, it's true actually. In my I was just saying to Oscar, I just read the book. This Is Going to Hurt by Adam Kay, who was a former junior doctor and obstetrician. So the guy who had delivered, you know, sort of thousands of babies, and having finished reading it, it is brilliant and funny and heartwarming, and also quite terrifying. My wife, who gave birth a month ago, said, "Oh, should I read it?" And I said, "Yeah, maybe give it a while.
Yeah, give it a few weeks."
Because the stuff you find out about what, and you know, I guess that's what where the insight that you must have as well. That's because the stuff that people just don't realise goes on behind the scenes when it comes to caring for children and babies. It's just some of it. I suppose just by the very nature, you are kind of guessing in certain situations, aren't you? And just trying, you know, best case scenarios and guesstimates.
Yeah. And I think the big thing actually for patients that I've found is that their perception of you changes if they know that you're a dad or a mother if you're a female doctor. So I think there's that reassurance that often you get very anxious new parents coming in, whereas before I still had the knowledge, I'd still done the training, I'd still done hours of pediatric on calls or whatever it might be. But they're sort of looking at you, and I suppose your confidence is not quite the same. And sometimes now, and once you've sort of given the medical bit, I say, look, my daughter had exactly the same thing. We did this, and then everything was fine. And often, actually, that's much more powerful than quoting some paper. Or...
So you will deliberately drop it into conversation sometimes just to make people aware that you understand the, you know, their concerns or their anxieties.
Yeah, I think it's one of the most helpful things you can do. And so it has changed how I practice in that way. But you also do feel it more for them, you know. I think before, for me, you'd hear them telling you about how they hadn't had any sleep last night because their baby was crying and they had a temperature all night, and yes, of course, you can imagine that that's not great, but now you really know what that's like.
Empathy is a great thing, isn't it?
And that empathy really comes through.
Has that changed? Do you think you've diagnosed certain things or treat, or maybe diagnose is the wrong word, maybe treated certain things, certain cases differently, having become a father, than you would have done beforehand?
Probably overall, everything's fairly similar. I think I may feel slightly more relaxed around babies generally. There's a big recent patient safety announcement about the number of babies who were dropped in hospitals in the NHS.
Yeah, I read it at the weekend in the Sunday Times, wasn't it?
And there's a lot of exactly. And there's a lot of chat about dads and parents generally. I can't remember the exact figures, but well over 90%, I think maybe even 95 or 99% of the people who dropped them were either the babies or the baby's parents or visiting relatives. And very few, luckily, were the healthcare professionals.
That's reassuring.
But I think even when you've done loads of baby checks, going around awards, seeing all the new babies, when you're doing sort of pediatric placements or jobs as a medical student and a junior doctor, if you don't have a child, there is still that sort of slight fear of the baby. But then also, you've got an advantage that you do have a slight detachment. I think sometimes being slightly emotionally detached, of course you want to be able to be empathetic, but having some emotional detachment is really helpful, because otherwise you end up in
you couldn't be involved. You might be in any given day you might be seeing what, dozens of children,
yeah,
I suppose.
Exactly. I remember when I worked in A&E and they were filming 24 Hours in A&E, I'd often find one of the assistant producers round the corner just in floods of tears, who'd been working on the sort of same case and looking after the same patient that I was looking after as a doctor. And you realise that there are so many different ways you can approach looking at something. And actually, if you spend too much time as a doctor thinking about the impact that, say, a new diagnosis of lung cancer is having on the family in that immediate emergency situation, you get a bit sidetracked away from the science and fixing the problem as much as you can there and then.
That's very interesting. It sparked a thought in me, actually, of the times when I have been in hospital with Ben, my oldest, and wondering, actually, if there are certain things I should have been asking or doing or thinking inquiring about that perhaps I wasn't. Because now I'm wondering, if you were in a situation where you were in with your daughter, you would obviously know it from the other side. You know what those guys, you know what their processes are, you know what their thought process is, what the next thing is, the pressures that will be on them in terms of other cases and workload. And I'm wondering if you would have any tips if you were somebody like me who was going in, you know, with a sort of, let's say, a non-emergency case where you're going in because you're concerned your child isn't very well. Would you give any specific tips to dads who were trying to think, okay, what's my first step here? How should I talk to the nurses? What should I say to the doctors? Are there any sort of magic buttons to press in that sense?
I think having a list of things before you go in that you want to ask is really helpful, because the number of patients who come to see me and say, oh, there's definitely something else I wanted to ask, or mum wants to know something and now I'm going to be in trouble because I've forgotten. And
I've said those exact words before.
And then I'm sure they get out and I'm onto my next patient and then they're like, oh, that was the question I needed to ask. So I think writing down what you want to know before is quite good. And it also focuses and helps the doctor, because there is a limited amount of time within the NHS. And obviously we prioritise looking after children who are unwell. So it's important to have that kind of list. Other tips? I don't think I'd do anything that differently. Interestingly, so when I went with my daughter for her injections, my wife, I was working, so I say sent, she had to go on their own with my daughter because I was busy. And I felt really bad afterwards. I thought the next time we're going to arrange it properly at a time where I can go. And I didn't tell them that I was a doctor. And I think often that's the best approach. And sometimes it's probably useful you have that insider knowledge. But often it adds stress. You know, people to the person who is the healthcare professional, if they think they're being monitored or watched. And that's often not what you want. You know, you don't want people these people are doing it, most of them, incredibly well all the time. And you want them to just be in their normal comfort zone, telling you, because if you start saying to people, oh, I'm a doctor, they'll stop telling you the information that they would tell a normal parent who they don't think knows. And actually, you may find that I haven't thought of that, or because it's your daughter, your mind is somewhere else. So also when I see parents who are doctors or nurses, I just try to treat them like everybody else. And if they say to me, I'm a pediatrician, you don't have to tell me about Calpol, then fine. But most people actually either don't tell you or are very happy to be in that kind of patient role, because it is a different place. You're more vulnerable because it is your son or your daughter.
Yeah, I could say, Steve, you were talking about... I was going to say, Steve, you were talking about when we had Chris Van Tulliken on.
Yes. He said that, you know, he did a documentary about Calpol and how perhaps we give it too often, and he finds himself giving it just in exactly the same way as the rest of us, even though he knows that we probably give it too often.
Yeah.
There's definitely being a doctor and being a dad.
And the two things don't often correlate, I presume.
No, not necessarily. I was originally going to call my book actually Doctor to Dad, because that was the sort of idea behind it, was that I had the medical facts and then suddenly I'd become the dad and actually none of the practical knowledge was there. But then we decided it sounded a bit too like a book just for doctors who were becoming dads, which was a bit of a niche market.
There's probably a few. What was it like for you around the birth? Because presumably, I mean, I know that's not necessarily you're a GP, you're not an obstetrician, but you must have had, you know, a very big understanding of all the questions around birth. Whereas, you know, I remember the first time with my first kid, and just being completely clueless and desperate. And I'm that sort of person who wants information. I want to know. It's like, no, tell me why you're doing that. And so I must have been annoying the hell out of all the nurses and midwives and doctors. Tell me why that's happening. Whereas for you, is it more a case of you already know, so you don't have to worry? Or does it worry you more because you know?
I think it's a massive combination of both. And the reason I wanted to write this book was because exactly that. I had that theoretical knowledge, you know, all sorts of exams, postgraduate exams, hours of on-call night shifts, both obstetrics and gynecology and also pediatrics, so kind of before and after the birth. But then I was slightly reluctantly taken along to antenatal classes by my wife, and I think like a lot of dads. Yeah. And I just sat in the first time, I'm learning so much. And if I don't know this and I've had all of this experience, what must everybody else be going through? And a lot of that is the practical stuff. And I think it's made me probably more relaxed, but that's definitely not the case for all doctors who become parents. I think there's a personality element as well. I'm fairly relaxed as a person. But a lot of my colleagues who have children, I know, you know, you're so acutely aware of all the things that can go wrong.
All the risks, all the dangers. Yeah. There must be a case where ignorance is bliss in certain situations.
I think there is. But when I've been talking to dads for the book, the time around birth, and particularly if people are in hospital, is obviously incredibly stressful for dads. And I think that's something we don't necessarily talk about enough, because these are often young men who haven't been into hospital that much. They're not familiar with that environment.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I found that really helpful. I think that was the biggest bonus for me. Yes, I was aware of, you know, if the heart rate's dropping a bit, you're sort of thinking, oh gosh, what's going on here? But actually, overall, I was quite at home. I've spent the last 10 years working in and around wards with midwives, doctors, bleeping machines, anaesthetists coming in, epidurals. So it almost feels like a bit like a second home. So I hope, for my wife's sake, that was quite useful, because I was fairly calm. And most dads I've spoken to say that they're trying to keep this cool dad persona above water, and underneath they are swimming like hell.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Well, what would be your tips then in terms of, because obviously the premise of the book, as you say, is that, you know, how to be a dad. It's to kind of know what to ask and what to do in these scenarios. So we have a lot of, you know, Steve and I know we have a lot of expectant dads who listen to the podcast trying to get as much information as possible before D-Day, as it were. So what would be your advice to guys who are going in, you know they're going to be going, their partner will be in labour soon. What should they be doing in terms of the way they communicate with midwives, nurses, doctors, etc. during a birth?
I think you really want to open those channels of communication. And to be informed is really helpful. If you know as much as you can about all the different possibilities, then the jargon, the lingo, the things that you come across as you go through that, often in a kind of complete rush, stressful situation at 3 o'clock in the morning with a bit of sleep deprivation thrown in for good measure, is a bit easier to comprehend. And even as a doctor, you're still thinking, oh, what's that? You know, when you're not working and it's not your job to be doing that, it's very different. And you're also there with somebody that hopefully you still really love and care about. And that makes it quite horrifying sometimes if they're in pain or discomfort.
I remember that feeling. That was a big surprise. You know it's coming, of course, but it's not until you see the level of discomfort and pain and agony and you think, my God, that's, you know, what can I do here?
Awful. And of course that for a woman in labour is awful, and hopefully as doctors we can try and reduce that significantly. But actually, often when you speak to them afterwards, mums even have said to me, I felt much more sorry for my other half who was standing there, because I was on the gas and air and slightly away with the fairies, and he's just there kind of in his jeans and t-shirt with all these people, perhaps, and hopefully not so much these days, slightly ignoring him. And he was horrified watching as, you know, they got out the episiotomy scissors.
There's definitely a bit of that. I remember when we had to go in for an emergency C-section, and I'm busy kind of, no, wait, explain it to me. Tell me what's going on. I don't know what's happening. Whereas my wife, because of course by that point she is away with the fairies. Yeah, fine. Let's just get on with it. You do feel stuck, I think, as a dad in those scenario, in those situations. You're not quite sure. You mentioned jargon and lingo. What are the, you know, obviously you did a lot of research for the book. What are the things that most surprised you that a lot of dads didn't know or understand?
Oh, where to begin? the whole
just ask
thing.
You to explain the book, basically. Haven't I? Sorry.
I think most dads knew how to get somebody pregnant, and that was often it.
Most, not quite
most,
all.
Most, exactly. Yeah. I think the whole most people know that it takes labour, particularly the first time, can take a very long time. I think understanding the different stages of labour and where the time to involve the midwives, when the times that you should be worried, you know, if there's, and I think those are the key things that people need to try and grasp, because once labour properly kicks in, as you both know, the person in labour is kind of doing their thing, and often now, you know, we're talking a lot about kind of hypnobirthing and mindfulness, and if they're kind of getting into that zone that nature intended for them to be in, they're not thinking exactly straight about the different phases of labour and how many centimetres this shouldn't be happening at.
Yeah.
And most of the time the midwives can support with that. But I think particularly if you're having a baby at home, just, you know, labouring in the early phases at home, it's really useful to have an idea about all of those different stages. And most dads I came across just have never even contemplated how that might happen.
Oscar, how, as a, you know, you're a busy professional man, have you found the kind of the work-life balance with being a new dad? Because you've got a, you know, broadcasting career, you're a GP, they're two quite busy jobs, and then suddenly you've got a you know, a small baby girl who, you know, you want to spend time with. How have you managed that?
Well, paternity leave was brilliant. That's the first time I'd had 2 weeks off in my whole career, I think. So I loved that element of it. But then, as with all these things, especially with the sort of broadcasting side of things, more freelance, suddenly just at the end of that, they said, would I come and film some documentary? So you're slightly off and away. I thought that, and it, I suppose it's something that all new dads and parents talk about, is the sleep element. And I thought that above everything, that would be something that I would have down, because I've done so many night shifts, still working in A&E on a ward, going to a cardiac arrest at 4 a.m. and having to really, you know, think in a stressful but also potentially life-saving situation. Mm. And I thought that would have prepared me for being tired at work and being tired just generally the whole time, and it really didn't. Because, and I've worked out,
is it a different
what,
sort of exhaustion?
Yeah, it's a different sort of exhaustion because there is no respite period. There's no day
no,
in
that's
lieu
exactly
or
it.
No, no week off.
There's no
after,
lie in.
No, exactly.
There's no Saturday morning lie in, is there?
Yeah. Before, you know, I could do a week of nights, you'd have a day or two off, you could have a lie in, and yeah. Now that's just not an option.
That is the thing, actually, and I think that's always my big red flag. If someone could have told me beforehand, you know, everyone talks about how all-encompassing it is as being a parent, and we all know that, but you're right, the lack of respite, that is the thing that gets me. And I do, on my bad days, I will say to my wife, when are we next, you know, when do you think we'll next go out for dinner, just the two of us? When do you think we'll actually get a lie in? Because, yeah. You know, I've got a month old. He's being breastfed. Okay, so basically for the next year, that you know, a year from now, I might be able to leave him for one night with my parents and we could go away for a night.
Yeah.
Literally, I've got one day of respite planned in a year from now.
Yeah. You're going to feel tired.
Yeah, yeah.
I think if you can find any period of time, even if just a couple of hours, and you're lucky enough to have a parent or a friend or somebody that you trust who can look after your baby, and you guys just go to the nearest whatever it is to just have
travel
a little bit of time. Yeah. Just a little bit. I think that's so important, and you've got to kind of fill up your cup to be able to give back, haven't you? I think that's such an important part of parenting.
Yeah, there's did you find
Oscar, you know, friends of yours who have got maybe had children before you, there's a sort of, you're joining a club where everybody is sort of experienced the same sort of thing, and there's a bit of solidarity in that, or because, you know, it's quite a stressful time for a dad, and there's the support networks that women have got well documented, but for dads, it's, and that's where this podcast comes from, really, we feel that there's not always that there for dads.
Yeah, I think you're right. You definitely get that sense that you are joining some sort of dad club. But then equally, I think a lot of dads, and it goes across all kind of mental health in men generally, we know that guys are worse at talking about it than women. Mm. And luckily, trends are changing and things that people are becoming more open. And hopefully that's where this book fits in as well. That in every chapter, I wrote the kind of medical factual stuff you need to know. But then for me, the bit that I think is most important and makes it most unique is that the second part is just how I felt, what happened, why my wife was throwing crockery at me and had never ever done anything like that before, or you know, how it felt when the midwife got out her episiotomy scissors, those sorts of questions.
Yeah.
I think you're right. I think dads don't, and yes, there aren't the platforms maybe for them to do it, but I think men are less inclined to speak about those things anyway, probably. So
absolutely, yeah.
We need an extra boost to encourage us to do that.
Well, that's, as Steve said, you know, that's partly what the podcast here, you know, that's what we're attempting to do here. And that's why when we heard about your book, we thought, God, this is, you know, a perfect match, because what you're doing in the book is essentially what we're doing in the podcast. Steve mentioned your friends and, you know, that kind of network, which made me think, actually, before you were a father, and perhaps even more so, were you often used as a kind of free medical consultancy? Did you, would you have friends kind of just doing the, oh, would you mind just taking a look at my daughter's this or my son's that?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, my WhatsApp's full of rashes and nappy related problems.
I have often wondered, I thought, you know, because you don't want to go and waste the NHS's time, of course, a valuable resource that, that is there. So I've often thought, God, if I just knew a doctor,
yeah.
if I had a doctor that I could just, I'll just send that picture.
You've got my number now.
Exactly.
Yeah, you do get all sorts of things, and it tends to be the photos of these kind of slightly uninterpretable rashes. And in fact,
has my kid got meningitis?
Last weekend we went to a friend's birthday, and then my wife got a text from one of the other mums saying, "Oh, actually, my child's just come out in chicken pox, and so hope your daughter hasn't caught it." And so there's this sort of week to 10 days of wait in every little spot that appeared. My wife and I think, "Oh gosh, is that going to be chicken pox?"
Yeah.
And then my wife took her swimming yesterday, and she was wearing a sort of wetsuit rash vest type thing, and came home, and I was at work, and I got this video of this huge rash that was all over her. And was it chicken pox? It doesn't really look like chicken pox, but I hadn't had a chance to think much about what else it might be, and she was apparently fine. And anyway, I got home and it completely gone, and of course it was just from whatever she'd been wearing in the swimming pool. Yeah,
this is the thing.
Yes,
the thing. It's good to know that happens to in doctors' families too, you know, because that happens at our house a lot.
Didn't we have a guest on right at the very beginning of the podcast, Rich? He was a doctor, and he told us a story about a man taking his daughter to A&E, saying that she had a straw-coloured liquid coming out of her nose, and it turned out that this guy was a doctor, and it was snot.
I had one patient once whose child had a really weird-looking rash and sort of bluey-black mark on their arm, and I suddenly thought, it was one of those moments, rare moments as a doctor where you think, I've really got this. And I got one of the sort of alcohol wipes that we use for cleaning the skin and just wiped it off. And it was just some biro mark that had sort of smudged into this potential mole.
You must get a lot of that. What would you say has been the most kind of, because I often worry about being, you know, like an overly nervous or cautious parent. You know, that's always what I'm thinking when we go down to the A&E or to the GP, and you think, oh God, this is really a waste of time, but we're going to need to do this, otherwise we're just going to worry. What has there been I mean, you've mentioned a couple of belters there, but are there any other examples where people have really kind of come in, you've thought, what on earth are you doing here?
Yeah, I think the thing that I struggle with most is, and it's such a difficult thing because children are vulnerable, you know, particularly children and elderly people. We try to really prioritise to see in the clinics. And children can go from very quickly from very fine to really kind of falling off the edge of a cliff. And so I completely understand, and even more so now that I am a parent, parents' worries. And so I think I'm less judgmental now than I perhaps was before, where there was that inevitable thing. You know, sometimes I look at my watch and they're like, I picked them up from school and they said they had a fever. And you sort of look at your watch and so it's 4 o'clock now. School must have finished maybe half an hour ago. Yeah. They're fine. You know, you've told me they're fine. Maybe some Calpol, see how they go, and then let us know. You know, it's actually very hard as a doctor to give an answer. And then people are very dissatisfied because I can't probably tell you why you're, unless there's an obvious cause, where this infection is yet. It might take a few hours for the rash to come out or the nose to start running or whatever it might be. But equally, you know, if you're worried about your child, then you have to get medical help, and you'd never forgive yourself if you didn't. And for every example of that I can give of, why did they come too early? There's somebody who will be able to tell you that they did go to the doctor, they didn't do something, and then something did happen. So it's very difficult. And it's what we do on a daily basis as doctors, is kind of assess risk and do our very best. I think most doctors do that all the time within their capabilities to do the very best for their patient. And inevitably, sometimes things catch you unawares.
Yeah, I'm sure.
And I guess what goes back to what you were saying earlier about the best person to tell a doctor how a child is the parent. And the more time you're spending with your children, the more you get to know about their little quirks. And, you know, some children are quick to tears, others take longer. Some kids have got a bad appetite all the time. Some kids are really good appetite, have a bad appetite when they're ill. And that's, I guess, how you can tell when something's not right, by just being aware of what is the normal.
Yeah, I think one of the things you learn early days in your sort of pediatrics at medical school is that ask the parents, speak to the parents. The parents do know their child. But then people get very worried, and sometimes that's why you go to a doctor, because you're going to see somebody who's been trained in making that assessment, isn't just using Dr. Google, and is also taking a more objective view than the sort of emotion, the sleep deprivation that we all know that you have as a parent, which can catastrophize even the smallest little biro rash or rash from something you wore in the swimming pool.
I'm going to remember the biro rash, I have to say.
Got a question, Oscar, about you know, the future of our children. I mean, you must have seen as a doctor the sort of rise of the adult obesity epidemic and all of the health we read today about obesity's, you know, as bad for you as cancer is. I mean, what can you see things on the horizon that, you know, our 15-month-old daughters are going to be in the midst of in years to come, based on the direction of travel for our, you know, our health?
Yeah, I was thinking about this just yesterday, because we've got her little kitchen, and we've got these sort of plastic food stuff that we ordered somewhere online. Yeah. And the first thing she pulls out is a burger, and she loves pretending to eat the burger. I thought, that's maybe not a healthy eating message for a 15-month-old.
No, no.
And I think, obesity, increasing levels of childhood obesity are all very, very worrying. And we have to do as much as we possibly can to try and minimise that. I think,
is that the big one, obesity?
Yeah, I think so, yeah. And so there's a lot of research now about obesity and the direct link between that and cancer, and obesity being a huge cause of cancer, which is something that we might have thought about before, but we didn't really know for sure as a medical community. So, I think we have to, as parents, I suppose you have to really think about trying to introduce healthy food groups, not just resorting to fast food, fatty foods. And I think luckily there is more of a cultural awareness of that anyway, but just because there's awareness doesn't mean that people are doing it. And like all of these things, you know, it's stressful, it's fussy, they may not want to eat the things that are good and healthy for them, which makes life more difficult. And when you've had a busy day and you're exhausted, then you just want your child to eat something. And we've all been there.
We have that all situation. Been there, definitely.
And fast food is cheap. Fast food is cheap. Pound or whatever, you know. Yeah. And we haven't necessarily got the skill set of, producing fresh meals that perhaps our grandparents had coming through the war.
Yeah, and I think that's such an important thing, you know, that the best thing, and of course it's difficult in a busy modern life, I'm sure, but, you know, if you're cooking freshly cooked, prepared home food with a good balance of all the different colours on the plate, as they talk about, the sort of healthy eating, and, you know, mushing some of that up and giving it to your child or whatever it might be, then that is probably going to be the best thing. I don't think we can expect everyone just to be having broccoli sticks and kale.
It's the first thing that Jackson says when he comes home from nursery, when he walks through the door and he sees me stood at the stove. He says, what are you cooking? Well, I want to see, lift me up, I want to see. And he gets a stool and he stands and he leans on the side of the cooker and watches to see what it is. And I just think it's so important for him to be interested and engaged in what he's putting in his body. And it'd be interested in it, and rather than it just be something that you tip out of a cardboard box onto a tray into the oven.
Yeah, and if you can generate that passion from a young age, then I suppose you're hopefully educating someone to be a healthy eater for life.
Fingers crossed, yeah.
Well, I'm aware. Who does like ice lollies, though?
Yeah. Hey, who doesn't like an ice lolly? Yeah.
What's on your stove? That's the question.
I'm aware we're sort of coming towards the end of our time here. I wanted to ask you one really big, very difficult question. So, in the book, of course, you've come up with, you know, there's a lot of information there. Is there one bit of info, of all the kind of info you pull together, the medical stuff, that you think would be really, really, if you were to pick out that one bit that would be most useful to most of the dads who might be listening to this, you'd say, okay, if there's one thing you remember, take it to be this. What would you pick out?
Yeah, so I was quite pleased with an analogy that I came up with for how the cervix opens up to let out a baby.
That was not what I was expecting, but let's go. Okay.
And that is, because that's the thing that you're waiting for. Everyone hears about this 10 centimetres and what
and
the
I
hell...
Still have, yeah. I'll be honest with you, I still have no idea what a cervix is, and I have had two children, so...
Okay, so what the hell does that mean? So, imagine a wine bottle.
Okay.
Turned upside down, cork still in, so nothing's going to come out. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the baby is inside, is the wine, if you will. So, the cervix is the neck of the wine bottle.
Okay.
Or the neck of the womb, which is what the cervix is. And over the time that labour happens, over the different phases of labour, the cork has to come out, which is the show. And when the cork comes out, you often get some fluid coming out with that as well, a bit like the wine around the wine bottle.
Yeah.
But the baby can't get out of the bottle until the neck both shortens and widens to let out the baby's head. And that is what is happening during all those contractions, that time of labour. During
you know your audience as well. You've come up with an analogy involving wine.
So
you
definitely know. That was it. And
that had me engaged from the get-go.
And it was a great moment when the illustrator came back with this brilliant picture of a baby and literally a baby in a bottle. And so I think that was the thing that I was like, how do you get this mythical idea of a cervix and somebody putting some fingers in to feel how wide apart something is? And so all that your midwife or your partner's midwife is doing, if they're examining your partner to find out how dilated they are, just means they're just putting their fingers inside and feeling for that neck of the womb or the neck of the wine bottle to see how big the opening is. And there you go.
Wow, well, I've genuinely learned something there. That was,
there you go.
You know, I think I had the basics.
If only we knew that.
Two kids down, you're there.
Yeah. I'll probably never need to know that again now. But yes, that's good. You know, after the fact.
I definitely won't.
definitely won't. Well, I think we've sort of come to the end
Oscar,
of
our
time. But yeah, that was brilliant. Thank you very much indeed. That's really, really insightful because it's really interesting. As Steve and I were discussing beforehand, you know, it's really interesting to get a doctor's perspective because obviously we all, if you have children, one thing you will all be doing is talking to doctors as your child develops. Mm-hmm. That's, you know, thankfully we have that system in our country and long may it continue. But it's always nice to hear it from the other side because you're never quite sure what's going on.
Yeah, I don't think it's any easier as a doctor.
Yeah, if you've listened to this week's episode and you have any questions about, you don't think we've answered, please leave them in the comments on iTunes and we'll endeavour to get to the bottom of any questions that are remaining.
Indeed, yeah, and please share the love and, you know, whether it be a question or a review or anything, like just show us some love on iTunes, on the podcast app, or you can listen to us through Acast or we're on Spotify as well, but... spread the word. Let people know we're here. If you're enjoying it, tell people.
Put us in front of some new dads.
Yeah, exactly. New dads. We need more new dads. Let's have some more listeners. Help us out, folks. Right. on that rather begging note, I think we'll say goodbye. Thanks again, Oscar, for coming in. Much appreciated.
Thanks for having me.
And Steve, get well soon, mate. And we'll have you back soon.
See you next week, mate. I'll be back in the office next week. All right. See you later.
Cheers, guys. Bye-bye. Bye.